song. Is it?
Hello and welcome to Whose Song Is It Anyway? A podcast with me, Dr. Hayley Bosher, co-hosted with Jules O'Riordan.
I'm Dr. Hayley Bosher. I'm a senior lecturer in intellectual property law at Brunel University, London, where I research copyright in the music industry. And I authored a book also called Copyright in the Music Industry, which looks at musicians and artists and performers' rights.
My name is Jules O'Riordan. I'm a partner specialising in music law at Sound Advice, based in Tower Yard in North London. I've also had a long-standing career in the music business under my moniker, Judge Jules, but I am not a judge.
I'm disappointed. My name is Jane Dyball. I'm a long-term music industry executive working mostly in music publishing, starting out at Virgin when that was an independent company, moving to Warner Chappell where I stayed for 20 years. And then from there I ran the MCPS, which is a collection society, about £150 million turnover, and which is owned by the Music Publishers Association, which I also ran. And since I left there, I have a consultancy business called Lafitte's Limited, where I do any number of things people ask me to do, including mentoring and coaching, really, for executives and small businesses, plus strategic consulting for bigger businesses. And I also do a fair amount of pro bono stuff. I'm involved in two charities and one non-profit organisation, which all focus on access to art and making arts accessible.
Wonderful, thank you. Well, you've got a good array of different roles to almost rival Jules there. So talk to us about your journey. I'm interested to hear more about how you got into the beginning of all the things that you mentioned and how you found yourself in those roles and what it is that you enjoyed about them.
So I went to university and I did a law degree at university primarily because I didn't know what else to do, and I was slightly horrified that everybody on my course was turning up in plus fours and waistcoats and watch chains and were sons of lawyers and grandsons of lawyers, and all wanted to work in the city. And I was studying it really just because, you know, I was good at maths at school and I didn't want to study maths at university. So you end up on a bit of a conveyor belt at one of those red brick universities and you find yourself going to Norton Rose, looking around and just contemplating a career in shipping law. And I thought, actually, I really don't want to do that. And everybody used to take the mickey out of me at university because I used to spend a lot of time listening to the radio and writing down lyrics instead of revising for my trusts exam. And so I took a year off and went travelling and thought...
It sounds like you had a very similar university experience.
Where did
to
you
me.
Go? Which one were you at?
I went to LSE, on the School of Economics.
Yeah, so it was quite funny because like in the second year everyone was cool and they started the second year with dyed hair and kind of hippie outfits, and then suddenly they got very straight as they started going to all their interviews to try and get their articles. So I took a year off, I went travelling, and I thought to myself, I've done enough horrible jobs to know how long 8 hours is in a day to work, and I decided that I was going to try and find a job that I really was interested in. And at the end of the year, I thought, I'm going to try the music business. And it wasn't like it is now, you know, where you can have careers advice at your fingertips. For me, it was a realization as I was putting records on the turntable that there were people credited, you know, there were companies credited and there were publishing companies credited. I didn't really know the difference between records and publishing. So I just sent out CVs. I sent out about 200 CVs and eventually I got offered a job at Virgin Music Publishers, and that's when I learned about publishing. And I was there for 6 years, and I started out Ironically, one of my first jobs was listening to records and writing down lyrics, because in those days it was Top of the Pops and they had cameras had to have lyrics and the artists who recorded them were all too busy to write down their own lyrics, which would have been a lot easier. So I had to listen to records and type up the lyrics, and then I built a career basically on saying, oh, would it be helpful if I did this? Or, you know, we don't have a director of managers, and we're always having to email managers and asking, like, you know, in those days, I don't know what it would have been, can't even remember, fax maybe, telex managers, and we don't have a list of all of their contact details. And then one of my jobs was sending out records when they were newly released around the world to all of our affiliates around the world. So I'd go, well, we don't have a release schedule, you know, publishers get information, you have writers signed to all these different labels, and there's no release schedule. We, you know, I'd suggest we do things like that, and then after a while I'd complain that I was overworked, and then I'd ask for a pay rise, and then I'd get promoted. So by the time I left 6 years later, when we were all made redundant with no warning, no notice at all, we just heard on the news one morning that Richard had sold the company. By the end of the day, we were all out of work. But by that time, I was doing a lot of international copyright and sync licensing, and I found myself then having to send out another 200 CDs asking for a job. And because one thing that Richard did was he enabled all of us to go on a how to write a CD course, which in some ways felt like rubbing salt in the wound.
Very prescient of him.
So when I went on it, they said, you have to put your law degree at the top because that's the most impressive thing about you. And I was like, oh, God, you know, I'm in serious trouble. So I'd be applying for marketing jobs, and then I'd get a rejection letter from the legal department because the marketing people would have handed it over to the legal team and they would have sent me a rejection letter. And I bumped into a friend of mine who was a lawyer at Warner Chappell, an in-house lawyer, at a gig. And he was going, what are you up to? And I said, I keep applying for all these jobs and keep getting rejection letters from legal departments. And that's, you know, if I have to do that, then shoot me. And he said, first off, Jane, actually working in-house doing legal work is really interesting. And second off, we are recruiting at Warner Chappell. So that's how I ended up. He always jokes that I said no about three times, and then he had to point out that I hadn't actually got a job or any means of paying my mortgage. So I went through the doors of Warner Chappell, which in those days had Bugs Bunnies everywhere, and I was going, oh my God, you know, this is not the music industry. But he was right, you know, and it was interesting. And Warner Chappell had a much broader catalogue than Virgin, and so you get involved in things like grand rights and, you know, classical and rental rights. And I got promoted. I started off as paralegal, then I got promoted to be head of department, and then he kindly left, and so I became director of business affairs in the UK. And then after that, I was promoted to being SVP International Legal and Business Affairs. So I ran the business affairs team for the world outside of the US, and then added to my kind of legal portfolio, I took over developing markets and sub-publishers and public policy. So I'd go to Westminster and Brussels and Washington to look at public policy issues, got involved in all the mergers and acquisitions. And then when the digital market came along, you know, in the form of ringtones, right back at the very beginning, there was no one really within the team whose responsibility that was. So then I became responsible for digital licensing and then collection society relationships, and I was the one that had to go and sit on the boards of PRS and MCPS and all of the trade associations in the UK and internationally. So my role kept...
Digital licensing. I'm going to stop you briefly there because it's very interesting, because I've been a lawyer now for about 10 years, and I started as a lawyer roughly when streaming came along, and I felt, well, this is a really great time to be in the business side, the right side of the music industry, because it's something totally new. And arguably, there's a little bit of scope for private practice lawyers to push the envelope here and to try and get the deals improved. And I guess that must have been quite an exciting time for you for digital. And there's it's quite difficult on this podcast to know the extent to which one goes very deep inside the deals and the extent to which one explains them on a slightly more, I don't want to say superficial, but a more understandable level. But I guess with digital, there's a lot, there's a legacy of certain artists, even coming out of the woodwork now, whose historic, very old record contracts didn't really cover digital properly. And a couple of whom, or some of whom, have been able to kind of almost get great returns on their recordings that were created well before digital. So that's a bit of a sort of background to this story. Did you find it very exciting and challenging being at the beginnings? Because, of course, when digital came along, it was all about Napster. It was all like doom and gloom for the recorded music industry. You were in the publishing side, so maybe it was slightly different. But was there an excitement to be part of a changing way of exploiting the rights in people's songs?
Yes, totally. I think once it gained momentum, particularly, at the beginning it was very clunky because the first thing that came along, as I said, was ringtones. And those were licensed by collection societies. And then downloads were licensed by collection societies. And the publishers generally were not very happy with how they were being licensed. I always used to use an analogy. If you imagine a kind of map of the world and where all of those lines are dividing France from Germany, that's where all the money went. You know, you kind of imagine these kind of caverns because it was all licensed on a single territory basis. And it was really hard trying to persuade the collection societies that they need to be more flexible. And famously, when Spotify came along, it was the most amazing thing for me. As a music fan, I couldn't believe it. And to have access to the beta version of Spotify and have a play with it and go, oh my God, I can type in a song and it will play it to me, was just groundbreaking. But they have real problems trying to get license from the collection societies because there wasn't a license scheme. Collection societies have to really run licensing schemes because they're monopolies, and if they have a scheme, then the scheme is put to the tribunal, which is what happened with downloads when there was an argument about what the rate would be. So when Spotify approached the collection societies, I was on the board at the time, and the decision of the board was to write to Spotify saying, we don't have a license scheme for what you're doing. Maybe if you come back in 18 months, you will, we'll have one by then. And to me, that seemed obviously a ridiculous approach. So for a long time, the publishers had tried to negotiate an online MOU, a memorandum of understanding with the collection societies to try and alleviate this and to try and create multi-territory licensing. And I think we must have spent about 7 years on this, and we were getting nowhere. And in the end, in 2005, the recommendation came out from Brussels, which we all really lobbied hard over, to have the ability to take back control of our rights and license them directly ourselves. And that then created this huge shift and with some considerable fallout because we were totally changing how things were being licensed. But once we'd done that, there was a period where every week you'd have a new entity coming in to tell you what their business model was. And that entity it was like being on Dragon's Den. It was like you're sitting there and they're coming in and they're saying, we've got this great idea, but to be successful, we've got to compete with free because everybody's getting everything for free from all of these different sources. So what we need to be able to do is we need to be able to offer all of your repertoire for free, and that will save piracy. And so you'd sit down and you'd say to them, well, how are you going to make money out of this? And they'd go, well, you know, it's not about making money. It's about making stuff available. For the reality for them was that they were going to make money by building up their business and then selling it, you know, which is what happened to MySpace, for example. You know, you build up your business, then you sell it. And then as the owners of that business, you cash in. But it used to make me laugh that people used to come in without any business model at all. And I'd say, well, look, if we're not going to make any money out of it, then we might as well have piracy. It's not, there's no difference. Either we make no money out of piracy or we make no money out of licensing you.
Interesting. Again, this is almost a bit of a historical episode of the podcast in that it's so easy to forget how different things were 10 years ago. And obviously there are really two monetization ways of making money out of music if you run a platform now. Correct me if you can think of any other ways, but it's either advertising or it's subscription. But it's astonishing how long it took a lot of the early platforms to realize that either you had to have a very low subscription base, you try and charge too much, it was very price sensitive. And the whole advertising model didn't really come in the first wave of platforms trying to use music. So I guess, again, that must have been quite an interesting time for you, almost challenging these startups on how the hell they intended to make money out of music. At the same time, and this is the historical context, from the background of a situation where I worked in a record label and my background is as an artist, and sold loads of records, record label doing amazingly. And then sort of in the early noughties, of course, you had Napster and you had the beginning of file sharing, which absolutely pulverized the music industry for a few years until we sort of evolved into this position. But I guess you were, everybody in the intermediary between the position we're in now and then was kind of slinging mud at the wall with different business ideas, but not necessarily fully comprehending how one can make money out of it.
Well, you'd look. I mean, that's why I loved it when they used to come in, all these fresh-faced business models. They'd usually come escorted by the same two lawyers who'd try and do all the talking. And I'd go, no, I don't want to talk to you guys. I want to talk to the people that have invented it. Because if you're doing, you know, in the publishing world, if you're doing a digital license deal, there's kind of three pillars on which you're negotiating. One is the revenue share and what percentage of their revenue you're going to get. One is the minima, whether it's a per stream minima or a per subscriber minima. And one is how much cash you're going to get and what the minimum guarantee is going to be or the advance. So I would make a judgment call on the basis of somebody coming in. You'd see somebody coming in with this massive VC-funded business model and you think you just don't have a business model, you're not going to be here in 18 months, so I'm just going to take the cash. You know, I'm going to get as much cash out of you as I possibly can. And so therefore the rev share and the minima become slightly less important, because the rev share is, you know, as I always say, you can have 100% of nothing and it's still nothing. You know, and the minima we're always,
I guess, as long as you're very good at judging whether somebody's got a potentially unsuccessful business model.
Yeah, I think that's true. But the ones that I thought would folded. This is all I'm saying. You know, you don't have to see, you don't have to be a visionary. I think sometimes if you ask the right questions and if you ask enough questions, and each time you ask a question, you get another question springing to your mind, then you can find that out. The other thing I used to do was I had an assistant, and I would say to him, okay, what would happen if we put these deal terms for this new service into Spotify traffic? You know, would we be better off or worse off than our Spotify deal? Or what would happen if we put the Amazon deal into the Spotify traffic or the Spotify deal into the Apple traffic? You know, you could, that's relatively straightforward to do. And the other thing that people used to do when they came in would, they'd be selling their service and they'd say, we're going to have 10 million users by the end of the first year. So then you go, okay, well, I'm going to have, my advance is going to be calculated on the royalty against 10 million users. And the reality is, you know, and they know they're not going to have 10 million users, but they've said that. So that gives you the opportunity to then, know where to negotiate from. But the ability to do that outside of the collection society system was just a game changer. We were still tied with the collection societies because of the performing right, which was assigned to the PRF. The mechanical right was owned by the publishers and usually assigned by the writers to the publisher. And the performing right is owned by the PRS, so you have to, manage that. But that's when I thought to myself, this is still going slower. We're much faster than we used to be in how we license, but it's still too slow. And that's when I hunted around to try and find an act who were willing to pull their rights out of PRS. And I sent one of those Friday afternoon emails to Radiohead's management going, I'm looking for an act who wants to pull their rights out of PRS. What about you guys? You haven't got a label deal. And to my astonishment, Bryce responded immediately and said, when can you get down to Oxford? And that's when I found out that they had planned this whole thing about In Rainbows, and the only bit that was missing from them was how they could do it outside of PRS. It was one of those kind of quirks of nature that those two ideas completely coincided at exactly the right time. So that then we went through this whole thing of them saying, okay, what does the world look like if you pull everything out of the collection society and you take full control of your rights? And we licensed the master rights alongside the publishing rights because they were outside of their deal with EMI. But it meant that if somebody had got if there was an online business in Israel, for example, they could be licensed in less than 24 hours. Whereas in the outside world, you have to involve ACOM, which is the Israeli Collection Society, and there's all sorts of issues around that. It would take 2 years probably to get to the convert. So that kind of pace of licensing is really what we were aspiring towards. But the reasons that we could do that with Radiohead were the same reasons we couldn't really do it with anyone else. It was great fun, really, really good fun.
And on the issue of rights societies, being a bit historical, to explain to those who are relative newcomers to the industry, there are two sets of rights surrounding music publishing. You've got the mechanical right, which is administered by MCPS, and you've got the public performance right administered by PRS. Historically, one joined them separately as a writer. And at some point, the two entities joined and sort of merged a lot of the admin function, thereby presumably bringing the running costs of collection and understanding the catalogue down. Do you? It's been an issue of controversy, the cost base of certain rights societies, because obviously they are operating on behalf of their members, and the more they need to be efficient. At the function of collecting and registering, but at the same time they need to be efficient financially because ultimately it's the members who are paying. How do you feel the sort of efficiency of those particular societies has evolved over time?
I can do 90 minutes on this, but I'll try and keep it brief. Collection societies historically have been very inefficient, but collection societies vary a lot from one part of the world to another, and so the level of efficiency varies a lot. Some collection societies have got a catalogue of 30 million songs on their database, and some have got 30,000, and are still using an Excel spreadsheet. So the PRS, for example, is probably the best or one of the best collection societies in the world. But the problem PRS had really was expanding its membership so drastically. So it had a membership of about 40,000, and God knows what it is now, but it went from 40,000 to 120,000 really quickly. And probably 10,000 people are paying for it. So it was probably 10,000 people paying for 40,000, and then it went to 10,000 people paying for 120,000. It's a real friction point because, at its most basic, a collection society is a socialist organization. It's you're better off together. But I think sometimes collection societies have to work very hard to reassure people that they're better off together, because if you're Elton John, you might think, actually, I'm better off by myself, thank you very much. I use him as an example because he's one of the people that really does support upcoming writers in any number of ways. But I think it certainly was a friction point, because when I took over MCPS had got a £20 million debt. MCPS was really dependent on the CD market. And the reason it had ended up with a £20 million debt was that it was sharing costs with PRS. And when that started, MCPS was the dominant partner with the most turnover, and PRS was smaller. But, forward wind to 2015, and MCPS is on the verge of bankruptcy. But it was tied into this relationship that meant that it had to share costs with PRS. And if PRS wanted to offer a Rolls-Royce service, MCPS had to pay a share of the Rolls-Royce service as opposed to the Reliant Robin that it could afford. And so MCPS was close to bankruptcy. MCPS is owned by the publishers, and there was a big decision as to what to do about it and whether at some point it was suggested that MCPS should be sold to PRS for £1, and then it could be fully merged. But the publishers felt that they wanted to keep their own organisation and their ownership of it, and so then I was brought in to run MCPS, and we went through a real recovery process, which involved renegotiating our agreement with PRS. And the only way that we could do that and get a really competitive price was to put MCPS out to tender, which is what we did, which was quite a radical thing to do, because what would happen if MCPS was administered by SACEM, or what would happen if MCPS was administered by Gamer? SACEM, the French society, Gamer, the German society. So it was a fairly radical thing to do, but it really was a game changer to show everybody that we were absolutely serious about it. And we also attracted some acquisition offers from different entities. That meant that MCPS could then live within its means, and it kind of validated the role of MCPS as a separate organisation. So they are still adjoined, if you like. PRS still administers MCPS, because at the end of the day they won the tender, and I think there's been another tender since I left, which they also won. And there's benefits of having those two run side by side, because they've got decades of history of being run side by side. But MCPS is in a much more a stronger position, both in terms of how it directs its business and in its financial security. So when I first started at MCPS, for example, I'd say we need to do this. What the business needs is it needs X, Y, and Z, and the response might be, well, that's not a priority for PRS, so we're not going to do it. So, but now MCPS is in a much stronger position in that it can say, we want to set up a licensing scheme for, a micro licensing scheme for amateur choirs who want to make recordings of their singing, and that can happen.
It's so interesting. I mean, there's so much to unpack, isn't there? But yeah, we're coming to time, so I don't know if Jules, you had another question, but I was just thinking that everything that you've said, Jane, about your experience and what you've kind of brought to the table in your different roles, it speaks a lot about your kind of problem-solving attitude, and I really love that. And I was just thinking, if you were going to talk to, say, I'm just imagining like my students listening to this episode and maybe thinking about going into a career in the music industry, especially in the kind of roles that you've done, like if you had a kind of a nugget of advice or something that you think really helped you in your career, what would it be?
I always say I've made a career out of common sense. When you're operating as an in-house lawyer, your role is very different from a private practice lawyer. Your role is to make things happen or get deals done or to make problems go away. So you have to be creative in how you approach that. Private practice lawyer, you're giving your client the options of different routes that they can take, but the decision is always theirs. So the ability to make a decision based on common sense and logic is key. And I think sometimes people shy away from that because they think, what if I make the wrong decision? Or what if I'm wrong? That's just a question of learning. You know, I had 6 years in music publishing before I started being a paralegal in music publishing. So I knew, I was, when I did my first negotiation with John Kennedy, who at the time was like the god of industry lawyers, I was like a quivering jelly. Until we had a conversation about controlled composition clauses, and I thought, he doesn't understand that quite correctly. And so you have confidence in your ability to understand the business and what the consequences of things are and how, what the financial impact of decisions are going to be. And I think that's very much on common sense. That, and when I used to work with younger lawyers, I've recruited shed loads of lawyers in my time, I'd often say to them, look, it's much better to make the wrong decision than not to make a decision. You know, you've got to keep the business going. If you make the wrong decision, you find out pretty quickly and then you amend it. Or you might make the wrong decision and no one notices, in which case that's fine too. But if you don't make a decision, everything comes to a halt. And that's the worst thing in a commercial organization. You have to keep things moving along.
Yeah, Jules, I'm interested to know like what your experience is in comparison to that as a private practice lawyer, and obviously you have your own other patchwork of experience in the industry. Like, does that align with your experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think lawyers get accused of being quite risk. Private practice lawyers get accused of being quite risk averse for fear of the wrong piece of advice coming back and biting them. Because of my background so varied, because I spent sort of 20, getting on for almost 30 years in the industry prior to being a lawyer, all I can do is provide I've got an anecdote to kind of sit as the backdrop to almost any bit of advice. And I can't, you know, the anecdote is true. You can either listen to the anecdote or not, but I'm not, therefore one can be a little bit more persuasive, dare I say it. Meanwhile, you're absolutely right, Jane, you have to... You do have to, in private practice, ultimately accept that some people will listen to what you have to say and others regrettably won't.
Yes.
That's interesting. Different skills, like you said, about the, and maybe different responsibilities in that sense. But yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jane. I don't know if you had another question, Jules, or...
No, that's great. It's been really, yeah, really interesting. Great. A different take from other episodes of the podcast. Really enjoyable.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jane. Really interesting.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe.